Wake Island. People who sleep only 2 or 3 hours in the 24 are always geniuses. The ones you hear about, anyway. Never mind if the ones you don't hear about are dolts. Insomnia is genius. It must be. Think of all the work you could do, the thoughts you could think, the books you could read, the love you could make, while the dull clods lie snoring. On the plain of the Orici, which is in many ways very similar to ours, there are people who don't sleep at all. A group of scientists in the Orici nation of High Bristle became convinced that sleep was a vestigial behavior pattern appropriate to lower mammals, but not to sapient humans. Sleep might serve to keep vulnerable simians quiet and out of harm's way at night, but is as irrelevant to civilized life as hibernation would be. Worse, it is an impediment to intelligence, a recurrent damper on the brain. By interrupting the brain's ongoing functions every night, by grossly interfering with coherent thought, sleep prevents the human mind from attaining its maximum potential. Sleep makes us stupid, was the motto of the Orici scientists. Their government, fearing invasion from the rival nation of Nuam, encouraged any experimentation that might give High Bristle the edge in weaponry or brain power. So, well-funded, working with brilliant genetic engineers, and provided with 10 patriotic pairs of fertile volunteers, all housed in a closed-gate compound, these scientists began a program nicknamed Super Smarts by the National News Net, which eagerly supported it. And in 4 years, the first entirely sleepless babies were born. Millions of bleary-eyed young parents might dispute that statement, but the usual baby does go to sleep, after all, just about the time its parents have to get up. The first super smart babies, however, died. Some died in their first weeks, some after several months. They cried day and night until they wasted away into silence and death. The scientists decided that infant sleep is an extension of the fetal development process that cannot safely be bypassed. High Bristle and Nuam were in a particularly confrontational phase. Rumor had it that Nuam was working on an airborne germ that would sterilize all High Bristlean males. Popular support for the Super Smarts program had been shaken by the loss of the infants, but the government did not waver. They sent the genetic engineers back to the drawing board and asked for a new set of volunteers. 22 patriotic couples signed up on the first day. In less than 2 years, they began to produce the new generation of super smarts. The programming was delicate and accurate. The newborns would sleep as much as ordinary infants to begin with, but would gradually begin to stay awake for longer and longer periods, until by the age of 4 they were expected to do without sleep altogether. And so they did. They did not waste away. They thrived. They were fine, healthy babies, all 22 of them. They stared up at their mothers and smiled. They kicked and cooed and sucked and crawled and did what babies do, including sleep. They were bright because much attention was paid to them and their learning environment was rich. But they were not geniuses yet. They learned what babies learn, including Gugu and Gaga and then Mama and Papa and No and the rest of the toddler vocabulary, at only slightly better than the average rate. Radical acceleration of learning and increase in active intelligence would come as they began staying awake. By the time they were 2, most of them were sleeping less than 6 hours a night. There was some natural variation in what the directors of the program called their asomnic development. The prize winner was baby Hadab, who gave up naps at 10 months and at 26 months was sleeping only 2 or 3 hours a night. For several months, Hadab, a pretty little fellow with big eyes and silvery curly hair, was the darling of the High Bristlean media. He was on everybody's home screen. Smartsy boy. Here was Hadab lurching cheerily across a room to greet the scientist general, Dr. Master Professor Uy Tug, author of Asomnia, the answer, who stooped with a pinched, though genuine, smile to shake his tiny hand. Here was Hadab rolling in the grass with a lapdog puppy presented to him by the supreme pinacular of High Bristle. Here was Hadab cuddling down in his little bed as if to sleep, thumb in mouth, but popping up again bright-eyed to mug at the cam man. Then Smartsy Boy faded from the net, as all fads fade. For over a year, little was heard about the Super Smarts program. The Hybrisalian, highly intellectual net locus then ran a non-interactive informational video which, carefully, raised some questions concerning the validity of asomnist theory and the super smartness of the Super Smarts test children. The most telling part of the presentation was a brief scene of Hadab, now 3½ and fully asomnic, playing with his lap dog. They were both charming little creatures, having a wonderful time roughhousing in the compound park. But it was rather troubling to see that the naked child followed the dog around instead of the dog following the child. Hadab also seemed curiously indifferent to the presence of strangers. When asked questions, he sometimes ignored the speaker and sometimes responded at random, as if neither speech nor human relationship meant much to him. Asked, "Are you in school now?" he wandered off a few steps and squatted down right before the cameras to defecate. There seemed to be nothing defiant about his action. It was purely shameless. Another child shown in the presentation, however, Ra Gana, a delicate girl of nearly 4 who had been designated as slow to develop because she was still sleeping 4 hours a night, responded with adorable verve to the reporters, telling them that she liked school because there were microscopes with wiggly things inside of them and that she could read her alphabet book nearly. Ra Gana, however, did not become the next media darling. The Super Smarts program refused to allow any more cam men on the premises for over 2 years, until public curiosity and media pressure became too strong for them to withstand. At this point, Dr. Master Professor Uy Tug announced that the asomnia test was successful. None of the 22 children, now just under 4 to just over 6, was sleeping more than half an hour a night, and all were in excellent health. As for their intellectual development, he explained that since it was of course not proceeding as that of hypersomnic children did, it could not be measured by the same standards. There was, however, no possible doubt of their very high intelligence. This did not quite satisfy the home screen audience, or the maverick scientists who had questioned the theory of asomnism, or even the government which was supporting Dr. Master Professor Uy Tug's program in hopes of a generation of geniuses who would bring Newham to its knees and confirm High Bristle as the supermost superpower in the world. After a good deal of time and pressure and committee meetings, a committee of scientific investigation, charged with making a disinterested report, was forced upon the fiercely resistant Dr. Master Professor Uy Tug and his staff. The investigators found many of the parents of the Super Smarts pathetically eager to talk to them, begging for advice, help, treatment for their children. One after another, these loving and desperate mothers and fathers said the same words, "They're sleepwalking." One young mother, uneducated but observant, set her little boy down in front of a mirror and told the investigator to watch him. "Mi Min," she said to the child. "Look, Mi Min, who's that in the mirror? Who's that, honey? That little boy, what's he doing?" But the child did not relate in any way to the image, as the investigator wrote. He showed no interest in it. He never looked into the eyes of the mirror image. Later I noticed that though his glance sometimes crossed mine at random, he did not look into my eyes, nor could I look into his. I found this curiously disquieting. The same investigator was also disturbed by the fact that none of the children pointed at anything or followed the direction of a pointing finger. "Animals and young infants," he wrote, "look at the finger rather than at the direction pointed at, and do not point themselves. Pointing as a meaningful and understood gesture is a normal spontaneous development occurring in an infant's first year. The super smarts obeyed direct, simple orders erratically. If told, "Go to the kitchen," or "Sit down," they often did so. If asked, "Are you hungry?" a child might or might not go to the kitchen or to the table to receive food. When hurt, none of the children would run to an adult crying about the owie. They just crouched down, whimpering or silent. A father said, "It's like he doesn't know what happened to him, like something happened, but he doesn't know what happened to him." He added proudly, "He's tough, a real soldier, never asks for help." Spoken endearments seemed to mean nothing to the children, though if offered a physical embrace, they might nuzzle or cuddle up to the speaker. Sometimes a child would say or hum endearments, "Nice, nice, nice, mama soft, mama soft," but not in response to loving words from the parent. They responded to their names, and most of them, if asked their name, would say it, though some did not. The parents reported that they increasingly seemed to just talk to themselves or just don't listen, and that their use of pronouns was often arbitrary, "you for I" or "me for them." All their speech seemed to be increasingly spontaneous, not responsive, random, not purposive. After over a year of patient and intensive study and discussion, the investigators published their report. Its language was very cautious. They put a good deal of emphasis on the case of Rog and Ah, who had continued to sleep up to an hour a night and even occasionally to doze off in the daytime, and was thus considered, in terms of the experiment, a failure. Roganaw's difference from the other supersmarts was vividly and unguardedly described by one of the investigators to a home screen reporter. "She's a sweet kid. Dreamy. They're all dreamy. She wanders off. I mean, her mind does. Talking to her is kind of like talking to the dog, you know? She sort of listens, but most of it's just noise to her. But sometimes she sort of shivers like somebody waking up, and then she's there. And she knows it. None of the other kids ever do. They aren't there. They aren't anywhere." The conclusion of the investigators was that permanent wakefulness appears to prevent the brain from achieving full consciousness. The media screamed with gusto for a month about zombie tots, the waking brain dead, programmed autism, infant sacrifice on altar of science. "Why won't they let me sleep, Mommy?" And then lost interest. The government's interest was kept alive for 12 more years by the unflagging persuasion of Dr. Master Professor Uy Tug, who had firm allies in one of the Supreme Pinacular's most valued advisors and several influential generals of the army. Then, abruptly and without public notice, funding for the project was withdrawn. Many of the supervising scientists had left the compound already. Dr. Master Professor Uy Tug suffered a heart attack and died. The distraught parents of the supersmarts, who had been forced to stay in the compound all these years, well fed and clothed, of course, and with access to all modern conveniences except communicative devices, got out and yelled for help. Their children were now 15 to 17 years old and entirely sleepless. With puberty, they had fully entered into the state some observers described as altered consciousness, others as waking unconsciousness, and others as sleepwalking. The last word was particularly inappropriate. They were anything but asleep. Nor were they oblivious to their surroundings, as is the sleepwalker who wanders out into traffic or tries to scrub the damned spot from her hands. They were physically aware at all times. They were never not aware. Bodily, they were healthy. Because they were fed well and regularly, with food always available, they had no hunting or foraging skills. They walked about, ran aimlessly, sometimes swinging on the playsets furnished them or from tree branches in the park, scratching the dirt into pits and heaps and wrestling with one another. As they matured, these puppy fights had begun to lead to sex play and soon to copulation. Two mothers and a father had committed suicide during the long captivity, and a father had died of a stroke. The 40 remaining parents had kept up a round-the-clock watch for years, trying to restrain their children, 12 adolescent girls and 10 adolescent boys, all awake all the time. The conditions of the experiment prevented the parents from locking any doors. They could not keep the young people from access to one another. The parents' pleas for locks and contraceptives had been rejected by Dr. Master Professor Uwe Tug, who was convinced that the second generation of asomnics would fully vindicate his theory, as expounded in the unpublished manuscript of Asomnia, The Answer is to Come. When the compound was opened, four of the girls had had babies, which were being looked after by the grandparents. Three more of the girls were pregnant. One of the mothers had been raped by one of the asomnic boys and was also pregnant. She was permitted to abort the fetus. There followed an obscure and shameful period in which the government disclaimed any responsibility for the experiment and left its subjects to fend for themselves. Some of the supersmarts were exploited sexually and for pornographic purposes. One was killed by his mother, allegedly in self-defense. She served a brief term in prison. At last, under the rule of the new 44th Supreme Panacular, all the surviving asomnics, including their infants, were taken to a reservation on a remote island in the vast Rumu River Delta, where their descendants have remained ever since, wards of the nation of High Bristle. The second generation failed to vindicate Uwe Tug's theory, but proved the skill of the genetic engineers. They bred absolutely true. No descendant of the supersmarts has been capable of sleep after the age of 5. There are now about 55 asomnics on Wake Island. The climate is very warm and they go naked. Fruit, cheese, bread, and other foods that need no preparation are left on the shore by an army jet boat every second day. Except for these provisions, tossed ashore from the boat, a strict no-contact policy is maintained. No humanitarian or medical aid is permitted. Tourists, including those from other planes, are allowed on a neighboring islet where they can catch glimpses of the asomnics from a blind through high-power telescopes. Teams of scientific observers are occasionally lowered from helicopters into two observation towers on the island itself. These towers, inaccessible to the asomnics, are equipped with infrared and other highly sophisticated viewing devices. The observers are hidden behind one-way glass. Pickets from the Save the Asomnic Babies Association are permitted to march and keep vigils on the south shore. From time to time, these Saba activists make rescue attempts by boat, but the army jet boats and helicopters have always forestalled them. The asomnics bask, walk, run, climb, swing, wrestle, groom themselves and one another, hold and suckle babies, and have sex. Males fight in sexual rivalry and often beat females who reject intercourse. All fight occasionally over food, and there have been a number of apparently causeless killings. Group rape is common when males are excited by seeing others copulate. There are some indications of affectional bonding between mother and infant and between siblings. Otherwise, there are no social relations. No teaching occurs, and there is no sign of individuals learning skills or customs by imitation. Most of the females bear a child a year from the age of 13 or 14 on. Their maternal skills can only be innate, and the question of whether human beings have any innate skills has not yet been settled. In any case, most of the babies die. The mothers leave dead babies where they lie. After weaning, children fend for themselves. Since an excess of food is always provided, a fair number of them survive to puberty. Adult female death is usually from brutality or complications of childbirth. Female asomnics seldom reach 30 years. Males live longer. If they survive the dangerous late teens and early 20s when fighting is all but constant. The longest-lived inhabitant of Wake Island, FB204, nicknamed Phoebe by the Observer team, was a female who lived to 71. Phoebe bore one infant at age 14 and was apparently sterile thereafter. She never rejected a male's effort to copulate and so was seldom beaten. She was shy and very lazy, rarely appearing on the beach except to pick up food and retreat into the trees with it. The current patriarch is a grizzled male, MTT311, 56 years old, muscular, and well-made. He spends most days basking on the sand beaches, and at night roams endlessly through the forests of the interior. Sometimes he digs holes and ditches with his hands, or piles up rocks to dam a creek, apparently for the physical pleasure of doing so, as the dams serve no purpose and are never made watertight enough to divert the stream. One of the young females spends a part of almost every night building up piles of torn bark and leaves like huge nests, though she never uses them for anything. Several females hunt for ants or grubs in fallen trees and eat them one by one. These are the only observed evidences of purposive behavior beyond the fulfillment of immediate physical needs. Though they are extremely unclean and the females age quickly, most asomnics are handsome in youth. All observers comment on their expression, described as bland, serene, supernally calm. A recent book about the asomnics was entitled The Happy People, with the Orici equivalent of a question mark. Orici thinkers continue to argue about them. Are you happy if you aren't conscious of being happy? What is consciousness? Is consciousness the great boon we consider it? Which is better off, a lizard basking in the sun or a philosopher? Better off in what way and for what? There have been lizards far longer than there have been philosophers. Lizards do not bathe, do not bury their dead, and do not perform scientific experiments. There have been many more lizards than philosophers. Are lizards, then, a more successful species than philosophers? Does God love lizards better than he loves philosophers? However one may decide such questions, observation of the asomnics, or of lizards, seems to indicate that consciousness is not necessary to living a contented, sentient life. Indeed, when carried to such an extreme as human beings have carried it, consciousness may prevent true contentment. The worm in the apple of happiness. Does consciousness of being interfere with being, pervert, stunt, cripple it? It seems that every mystical practice on every plane seeks precisely to escape from consciousness. If nirvana is the mind freed of itself, allowed to rejoin the body in the body's pure oneness with its world or God, have not the asomnics achieved nirvana? Certainly consciousness comes at a high cost. The price of it, evidently, is the third of our lives we spend blind, deaf, dumb, helpless, and mindless, asleep. We do, however, dream. The poem Wake Island by New Lap portrays the asomnics as spending their whole life in a dream of dreams. Dreams of waters flowing always by the sandbars. Dreams of bodies meeting, opening like deep flowers. Dreams of eyes forever open to the sun and stars. A moving poem, it offers one of the very few positive views of the asomnics. But the scientists of High Bristle, though they might like to agree with the poet to ease their collective conscience, assert that asomnics do not and cannot dream. As on our plane, only certain animals, including birds, dogs, cats, horses, apes, and humans, regularly enter the peculiar and highly specific brain-body condition known as sleep. Once there, and only there, some of them enter the even more peculiar state or activity, characterized by highly specific brainwave types and frequencies, called dreaming. The Asomniks lack these states of being. Their brains do not do this. They are like reptiles who chill down into inertia but do not sleep. A High Brasalian philosopher, To Had, elaborates these paradoxes. To be a self, one must also be nothing. To know oneself, one must be able to know nothing. The Asomniks know the world continuously and immediately, with no empty time, no room for selfhood. Having no dreams, they tell no stories, and so have no use for language. Without language, they have no lies. Thus, they have no future. They live here, now, perfectly in touch. They live in pure fact. But they can't live in truth, because the way to truth, says the philosopher, is through lies and dreams.